Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Women Who Inspire. I'm Cynthia Poehler, and my guest today is Lynn Jackson. And Lynn Jackson has been an environmental activist for many, many years. So, Lynn, how's it going?
Well, these are very strange times we're living in with the novel coronavirus. But
right.
I am quite pleased that you invited me on your show to talk about what it's like to be an environmental, you know, what kind of environmental activism I've done. I think it all started when I was a little kid, and there were two things that really impacted me. One was I used to watch the washing machine would drain soapy water into the sink. And I always thought, I'm glad I don't live downstream from that. And later on, of course, I learned that people do live downstream. So that was one thing I learned. And the other was we used to, I grew up in Endicott, New York, and we used to drive to Binghamton a lot. And I remember watching bulldozers, you know, on the drive, just bulldozing away, you know, hills and trees and making, building more stuff and parking lots and buildings. And it always really bothered me. The first Earth Day was a really big deal. I was in high school at the time. I wasn't involved in any groups, so I didn't do anything special. But I certainly remember the first Earth Day. It's when I came to SUNY Albany as a student that I searched out my people, or the people involved in environmental activism. You know, I went to school in the mid-70s, and that was the time when, you know, the river was on fire, I think in Ohio, and the air pollution was terrible. And it was just at the time when the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act went into effect. And I don't know if people remember how bad the environment was in the 50s and the 60s and the early 70s. You know, on a hot day, you'd sit there with a line of cars and all this black smoke would poof out of every exhaust pipe. Student going to New York City, the air was filthy. It was just filthy. And it was the environmental movement that I think is really inspiring, because it really changed how we feel about the environment. You know, clean air and clean water are right, and I think they are really important for people. Now, these days, I think sometimes that environmentalists are the most selfish humans of all, because we realize if we don't save the earth that we'll die, and we really have to save our earth, and we have to save our ecosystems, and we have to save our plants and our animals and have clean air and clean water and learn to live in a way that does not harm the earth and maybe possibly enhances it. Currently, with this pandemic going on, it could be started because of the imbalance in our environment. These viruses, like the novel coronavirus, like Ebola, and other similar type of viruses, have a reservoir in animals. And that it is this human-animal interaction that brings the virus into the humans. And that's why I think the animals need more places to live, so that humans and animals are more separate, so that we're not affecting the animals' environments. We need to be more separate from them. And so I think that much more study has to go on between the habitat and the needs of animals, and of course then of people.
You know, it's really funny that you should talk about that, because, you know, when you put the TV on and they talk about, you know, all these animals, they're coming out and roaming areas that they haven't roamed in quite a while. So if they could think the way we think, they're probably saying to themselves, what happened to all of these crummy humans? Did they all disappear? Look at how wonderful it is now. You know? I think it's amazing. It's only like a month, and all of these wildlife species are, you know, roaming streets and different areas, and I'm just thinking, wow, this is, you know, it's good. And, you know, the air pollution, they've been showing a picture of Paris and the Eiffel Tower, like before the pandemic, and it was all cloudy and hazy, and now you could see it a lot clearer. So I think within this short period of time, there has been a lot of, you know, progress towards a better environment, wouldn't you say?
Oh, yes. I think this pandemic is showing that with less human activity, we can really clean up our environment a whole lot more. And it shows how much work we need to do. I mean, when we go back to, well, quote, air quotes, normal, you know, and people start driving around again and we have airplanes and cruise ships and all that stuff, you know, we're going to start polluting the air again and polluting the water, and the mm-hmm. animals are going to go back to wherever they came from. But I think that we really need to take a moment and look at these incredible changes in the environment, and that we need, that there's a lot of stuff that we need to do to not so greatly impact the environment. I mean, one of the issues right now is that we're undergoing the sixth major extinction in the history of the world. And by that is extinction of animals at this time. And there's been, you know, the very famous extinction that everybody knows about is the dinosaurs, right, when the asteroid mm-hmm. hit. But right now, because of human activity, we are losing our diversity of species, and we're losing animals. And it's rapid, and it's very significant. We're losing insects, and it's a disaster. When I was a little kid, my father used to fly model airplanes, so we would drive out to some place in the sunshine and, you know, a big airfield and fly model airplanes. And whenever we got into the car at the end of the day in July, the car would be full of insects all over the windshield and the dashboard, full of insects, just full of insects. But these days, you know, there's no more insects. You drive around all day in the summertime and there's no insect splat on the windshield. The insects are disappearing, and this causes the birds to disappear and the bats to disappear and all the animals that eat insects, and it's really a disaster. So the focus of most of my activism has been involved with one particular ecosystem and its habitat. And when I think about how much time and effort it's on the parts of many, many, many people, because I've only been a kind of a minor character in all this, It boggles my mind about how much work we have to do to save our ecosystems. So the ecosystem that I've done the most work on is called the pine bush. And the pine bush is a fire disclimax pine barrens community located between Albany, the capital of New York State, and Schenectady, which is a city a few miles west of Albany. And this is an ecosystem of pitch pine trees, and we have pitch pine trees and sand dunes and scrub oak and blue lupin and all kinds of other really cool plants and animals that live there. So I got involved with the Pine Bush. I didn't really mean to get involved with the Pine Bush, but I did because I knew about it when I was at SUNY, when I was a student at SUNY. And I had been out there. I'd participated in cleanup. Now, the Pine Bush used to be considered just a wasteland, just a total wasteland. And it was just a people would dump out there. There was I can remember when I did a cleanup in college that there would be like piles of roofing shingles, and there are old cars, like really old cars from the 20s and the 30s, in ravines and in holes, cellar holes, and I don't know. There was just garbage everywhere. It was so what happened is that there were so the reason that Pine Bush is very attractive to developers, not only, of course, its location, because it's kind of in the geographic center of the Capital District of upstate New York, but also because it's all sand, and so it's really easy to build on, because this is beautiful sand. And the city, just before I came to live in Albany, the city of Albany had built this four-lane highway to nowhere, the Washington Avenue Extension, which when I was a student, it was just four lanes of road that really literally went nowhere. It intersected with this other road, and that was it. And there was no buildings out there. There was nothing out there. So what happened with Save the Pine Bush is that there was a snowstorm on February 6, 1978, and the planning board that night was going to hold a public hearing about four proposed developments in the Pine Bush. Now, I was told about the hearing, and a lot of people were going to walk over to the Albany Public Library to participate in the hearing. But there was so much snow. It was a huge snowstorm. This snowstorm was so big that the governor of the state of New York sent all the state workers home at 3:00 in the afternoon. Now, at the time, the mayor, that would be Mayor Erastus Corning III, his philosophy of snow removal was what God giveth, God will taketh away. And so there was no plowing of the streets. There was probably 6 inches of snow on Washington Avenue in downtown Albany. And a bunch of us met at the Larkin, a restaurant which is no longer in existence on Lark Street in Albany. And we were wondering, are we really going to have the hearing? So we all walk over to the library, and yes, they had the hearing. So the developers got up, and they spoke for like an hour and a half, and they talked all about the houses they were going to build and the warehouses they were going to build and all the stuff they were going to build out there. And after about an hour and a half, they were done with their presentations, and the Richard Patrick, the city planner, let the people in opposition speak. And after we got to talk for about an hour and a half, Richard Patrick got up and said, "Well, the weather is getting kind of bad out, so I'm going to close the hearing." And, of course, not everyone. There were probably, it's hard to remember, but I think there were probably like 20 people in opposition of the proposed development. And not everyone got to speak. Most people didn't get a chance to talk. And we were pretty outraged that we were not allowed that the hearing was closed before everybody was heard. So the upshot of all that is that a group of us began to meet on a regular basis and talk about, well, what can we do about this? Because, you know, the Pine Bush is really important. It's an important ecosystem, and we want to save the Pine Bush. How can we, deal with this tremendous injustice? Because it was an injustice. It was a terrible injustice. I think that is part of what drives my activism is that I see that it's wrong, like with the pine bush, it's wrong to go build new buildings in the pine bush when in my own neighborhood in downtown Albany, in the south end of downtown Albany, we have so many vacant houses and vacant lots and vacant land. You know, that's why we have cities, because density is good. In a city, you want people to live together so that we can, you know, that, you know, you don't need as many streets, you don't need as many services because everyone lives closer together, so you don't need to build so much. People don't need to rely on cars so much. People can walk around. That's why density is good. But building out in the pine bush, where at this point there's really literally nothing out there, is morally wrong, because we need to look at, you know, where our spaces are. So the upshot of all that is the group found a lawyer. His name was Victor Lord. He's unfortunately no longer with us. And he told the woman who is my inspiration, Regin Adams, and he told Mrs. Adams that he would do one lawsuit. So he did one lawsuit, and back in the day, it was really easy to file lawsuits against the city of Albany because the city of Albany didn't follow the rules, and everything they did was like wrong. So the planning board of the city of Albany had four members. In the 1950s, the state of New York had required municipalities to have planning boards, and that unless the local law said something else, that you had to have a minimum of five members on a planning board. But Erastus Corning had only appointed four for all those years, you know, 20 years or however long it had been. So we won our first lawsuit because the city hadn't appointed enough people to the planning board. So what did we win? We won another public hearing. So we had the hearing in July of 1978. And our goal was to get so many people to come to the hearing that they would have to schedule another hearing because it would be too many people. And we were able to achieve that goal. But of course, finally, you know, after two hearings, the planning board approved the projects. And at that time, two of the developers dropped out with their proposals at that time. And we began litigation on other issues. And so that started about 35 years of constant environmental litigation over the pine bush. And that was my early activism, is basically I, you know, participated as I could and watched other people and followed the lead of other people who knew more about the law and how to organize. And it was, it was really interesting.
So Lynn, tell everybody about the importance of the pine bush.
So the pine bush at that time was considered just a wasteland. But say the pine bush really put it on the map because of our litigation. And the reason it's important is some people say it is the best example of an inland Pine Barrens ecosystem in the world. Now, Pine Barren ecosystems are not particularly common, is my understanding. Some people might be familiar with the Pine Barrens on Long Island. There are Pine Barrens in like southern New Jersey. There are Pine Barrens in Indiana. And there are other Pine Barrens ecosystems in other parts of the United States. But they're not very common. But if you'll notice, the Pine Barrens that I have already named are all next to a large body of water. The pine bush, on the other hand, is not next to any large body of water. It is a ecosystem. It is believed that during the Ice Age, I see. So how is the pine bush formed? We should talk about that for a minute. So during the ice age, there was, I don't know, a mile high wall of ice that covered North America, and it covered all the way down the Hudson. And I'm not sure how far this ice sheet went, but it went pretty far. As the ice sheet retreated, the water from the Great Lakes flowed down the Mohawk River Valley and down the Hudson. Instead of draining north into the St. Lawrence, it drained through Albany. And that was Lake Albany. Then when Lake Albany dried up, it left these beautiful parabolic-shaped sand dunes. And these sand dunes aren't near any body of water because Lake Albany is gone at least, has been gone at least 10,000 years, if not more. And if you look at aerial photographs, you can see the beautiful shape of these sand dunes. And they're these you know, parabolic shapes. So they look like boomerangs, and they all point in one direction. So they mostly point east. So the rounded part of the dune points east, and their little tails are facing west. And it's really quite something to look at a photograph of that. Now, so what is the pine bush ecosystem? So the dominant species in the pine bush are pitch pine trees and scrub oaks. And pitch pine trees are not Christmas trees. I think they're, some people might think they're ugly. They look a little scrawny. I think they have a, they are absolutely beautiful. They tend to be straight trees. You know, they're not, they tend to grow very straight. And the needles sometimes will grow right out of the bark, which is interesting. And then they have many branches, and they kind of look like Charlie Brown's Christmas tree, but they're wonderful. And they have a sparse open canopy. So when you go to the pine bush, it's not like you're going to be in this forest. It's that you can see the shape of the sand dunes, which is really cool because the trees are far apart. And then in between the trees, there are very low scrubs, like the scrub oak is probably no more than like 18 inches high, maybe two feet. And then, of course, the most famous resident of the pine bush is our beautiful Karner blue butterfly. And the Karner blue butterfly has a really interesting life cycle. And it so the Karner blue was given its Latin name by the author Vladimir Nabokov. So there's different stories about his trips to Albany. One of them is that Nabokov did not drive, so he lived in Boston, but he did a lot of work in Ithaca. So his wife would drive him to Ithaca from Boston, and what's on the way but the pine bush. And so he would drive into the pine bush, and then at that time, there were, you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of these beautiful blue butterflies. And the Karner blue adult butterfly only lives maybe 2 to 3 weeks, maybe a little longer, not much. So basically, the butterfly comes out twice a year. They make an appearance at the end of May, beginning of June, and then for 3 weeks in July. So if you go out to the, so back in the day, you know, before we had such ecological destruction, you could go out in a pine bush at those times and it would be clouds of butterflies. And Nabokov actually wrote about the Karner blue in one of his novels. So the Karner blue is its most famous resident, but there are also other endangered and rare species that live there. There's a couple other butterflies. We have some there's an interesting little toad called a spadefoot toad. I've never seen one in person. They're so interesting. These creatures are so interesting. So they have their back feet look like little spades, and they actually dig under the ground. So they, most of the time, their life cycle, they live underground in the sand for like, maybe they dig themselves maybe 4 feet underground. And then they encase themselves in this mucus-like stuff, and then that's where they stay until the rains come. And when it rains and rains and rains, they come out with the vernal ponds. And vernal ponds are ponds that only fill up with water during, like, the spring when it's really wet out. And then they come out, and then they mate, and they lay their eggs, and then they go back into their, they dig themselves back in the sand. And then we have the hognose snake. I know, you know, some people don't like reptiles and amphibians, but these are animals that are declining rapidly over in New York State and around the world, and we need to save them. They play very important roles in the ecosystems. But they have the hognose snake, and I've talked to people who study these snakes. They are so interesting. One of the things that they'll do is when you come upon a hognose snake, first they want to scare, the snake wants to scare you away. So what the snake will do is kind of flare out the skin around its neck, so it kind of looks like a cobra, but it's completely non-poisonous, and it's never not going to bite you, and it's not going to hurt you. And if you don't fall for being scared of the hognose snake, then it might just roll over and play dead. And it plays dead even to the point of having a little spot of blood on its mouth to show you it's really dead. So they're so interesting. It has all these wonderful critters that live in the pine bush. Now, these days, there is the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission, which I'm proud to say we sued into existence, but that's another story. So the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission has done a lot with birds. Now, bird species are also on a big decline. And one of the species that are having difficulty are birds that live in grasslands, because birds live in all different kinds of ecosystems. So with the commission restoring the pine bush back to its original condition, many of the migratory birds have come back to the pine bush, and which is really important, because migratory birds need to have a place to stop off and eat and rest before they continue on their migration. So there's a lot of bird studies going on right now in the pine bush, which is really good. So the pine bush is really, really, really important an ecosystem to save.
Lynn,
yes?
Our time is up for the day, but I'm sure you have many, many other stories. So would you be interested in coming back on Women Who Inspire and telling us more of your environmental stories?
I would love to tell you. I could tell you stories for hours. But yes,
okay.
We've had many adventures, many, many adventures. So yes,
okay.
I would love to come back.
If somebody's interested in knowing more about the pine bush, how can they do so?
We have a website, savethepinebush.org, savethepinebush.org. We have email, pinebush@mac.com, and we have a Facebook page, Save the Pine Bush.
Thank you, Lynn.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much. Oh, and then we have,
okay,
when the virus is over, we have lasagna, monthly lasagna dinners, and the lasagna is delicious.
Okay, thanks. We'll talk again, and thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.